thank you very much, everyone, for joining us today. We've been trying to get this Zoom link onto YouTube for a while now. It hasn't been working, but we're here to do our finals preview, and we're doing it in the company of Jack from Big Cricket. Jack, how you doing, mate?
Good, thanks for having me back so soon.
Yeah, well, it's lovely to have you, mate, and it's great to kind of preview finals day today. We've got your mailbag questions in, so we'll be going through those. We'll kind of review the games from last night, and yeah, look ahead to finals day today. Let's start with the women's game from yesterday. Heroics from Nat Siver in the end, Jack, who I think scored 72 off 36, three consecutive sixes. Looked like she could take the game down, but just didn't quite have enough. Bit of a weird game. It felt like the Brave maybe didn't have enough on the board until the final 10 deliveries or so. And the Trent Rockets, bar Nat Siver, kind of really threw it away.
Yeah, it was a strange game. And obviously, you know, a fantastic innings from Siver. I think on balance, the better side won and got through to the final. I think the Brave have been a really kind of a really good outfit this year. But yeah, in the end, they just brought it back so well with the ball, didn't they, the Brave? And I think looking back at it, Trosol's, 20 balls, 12 runs, that ridiculous economy is going to probably won the game in the end.
I think so. And I think it's a case of, ultimately, they just kept the openers quiet enough early on. I think Villani made 25 off 26, if I'm not mistaken. 24 off 25, sorry. And Bryony Smith, 16 off 15. Then nobody past Siver at three made more than eight. The highest strike rate bar Siver was 114 from Marie Kelly, 8 off 7. So it was just a bit of a disaster, really. And I feel bad for Nat Siver, because I think often she seems to be on the end of these games where she utterly dominates and the rest of her side completely collapse. So it's a little bit of a weird one. And it's kind of a throwback to last year's Trent Rockets, almost so dependent on their stars that they just can't make it work. And the Brave were ultimately the better side on the day, and I think also the better side just in terms of this tournament overall.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, at the start of the season, I really thought the Rockets were going to have a really strong batting lineup, and they wouldn't be that kind of over-dependent side because they just bat so deep. But I think maybe they've made some interesting decisions in batting order, etc. And like you said, Siver was going it alone, but against a competent bowling lineup, you can't really win a game by yourself. It's very, very difficult, unless there's like a significant chink in the armour of the opposition and there just isn't with the Brave, and no one went with her, and in the end, you know, they came up short.
I think what the big issue was, really, was that the bowling kind of slipped away from them at the end of the day. I think Georgia Adams obviously came in and played a nice innings at the back end, 38 off 24, which kind of changed the game. They bowled Bryony Smith at the back end, that kind of went wrong. Only 15 deliveries of Siver, only 10 deliveries of Sarah Glenn. Just felt like they didn't quite manage their bowlers as maybe you'd want them to do. I know Elise Villani's going to have been captain the last couple of games. I just don't think it worked. No, Natalie Siver gave it up, but there's arguably other captains I might have turned to, Mignon Dupriya, for example. But anyway, I just think that Nat Siver couldn't drag that Brave and drag that Rocket size anywhere, really, which is unfortunate because it was a great innings. Just a disappointing one, really. I felt a bit bad for Tali McGrath as well, because obviously she went out there as the kazoo match hero, having just been pumped for 20 off the set. It must have been a little bit demoralising for her, bless her.
Yeah, I didn't actually realise that. That's quite a strange decision, I think, there, but yeah, but it wasn't her best night, really, was it? But I mean, she's a fantastic cricketer. But yeah, overall, it was, like you say, it was a strange game. But I think in the end, it was the right result, really.
I think it was. And we'll preview women's finals there in a moment. But let's go to the other eliminator game, shall we? It was the Manchester Originals versus the London Spirit. This was an interesting game because the London Spirit started the tournament on a heater, like an absolute heater. And then obviously London kind of fell away a little bit, really, and just struggled to keep that momentum going. Obviously, they lost Maxwell, lost Pollard, McDermott and Inglis didn't really get going. They were depending on Ravi Bapara to kind of fill that Pollard role, and he batted quite nicely in the last couple of games. But they just lost their momentum completely. And then the Manchester Originals, who are terrible to start this tournament, come in off the back of 5 wins in a row, and I thought played really, really nicely. And I think they got the approach to the innings correct in the way that the Trent Rockets women didn't. Obviously, Evans and Salt saw that target of 150 and thought, right, we're going to get ahead of the game. Laurie Evans doing a great Phil Salt impression, I thought. He just played really well and took the bowling on. I think in a chase like that, that's what you need to do. 72 off 34, he ended that game. And that's what we thought they do ultimately, because, you know, the Spirit have good pace off bowlers. They have Dawson, they have Crane. They could have turned to Dan Lawrence. They probably weren't going to with the amount of right-handers in the Originals lineup. So they had to take on Chris Wood and they had to take on Jordan Thompson. And they did. And to their credit, they just went, took the game by the scruff of the neck early on. And I think really ended it within the power play just by being that aggressive. So I thought that approach from Evans and Salt was fantastic.
No, definitely. I mean, when you look at London Spirit's bowling lineup, you're thinking those opening bowlers are probably their two weakest bowlers, perhaps. Certainly Wood is probably the weakest of the 5 they're bowling. So you really have to get after them early. And they took it to extreme, like you said, Evans 72 or 34. That's a great innings. And you're obviously not going to do that every time, right? Like, that is an exceptional innings. But even if that was, you know, 30 or 15, you're still so ahead of the game when you're scoring at that kind of rate. And they taper quite nicely, Salt and Evans as well. I think they have kind of different weaknesses, essentially, against spin, for example. And I think they're forming a very good opening partnership. Like, you'd rather have Butler there, but they were so effective yesterday. And like you said, by the time Ellis came in, the game was virtually over anyway. And that's what you want to do. You want to strike early and get in before the game changes, the other team can get on to bowl. Because then they lose their effectiveness, essentially.
I find Laurie Evans a very weird cricketer. Like, I can't judge whether I think he's good or not. It's really weird because ultimately he's done really well in the Big Bash recently. He's finished games in the Blast for a while. He played pretty well in the 100 last year when he actually got an opportunity for Oval. Yeah, his strike rate overall, whenever he's in the Blast, is around 125. For me, he's never been a cricketer I've really wanted on my T20 team because of that kind of lack of intent, I guess, especially in the middle order. But then he comes out in the big games, absolutely smokes it. Like, I've never seen him hit it that well. Like, he was absolutely phenomenal, like properly looking like a 125K player tonight. And what I like is that he's taken the responsibility of this side on his shoulders. He's gone up to open with Josh Butler, which is absolutely massive. The fact that he's gone and done that, I think, is frankly really impressive. He's gone, taken that responsibility, as well as the captaincy. And he's a better captain than Josh Butler. I think that's relatively clear. Love Josh. His captaincy at the moment has a lot of developing to do. Laurie's come in, led this side from the front. I think captained quite nicely in general. And has turned around a team that were looking absolutely terrible early on, right to the top. And it's these weird cricketers that the Originals have found in the front. It's Laurie Evans who has got the 125K gigat. No, it's Paul Walter, who's suddenly the best bowler in the competition somehow, despite not having bowled for Essex at all this year. They've just managed to make it work. And I don't like fully know how they've done it, but they have. I mean, it's... Yeah, I don't understand this team. I really don't. I thought Josh Little bowled nicely early on. Those 2 wickets he took, and Rossington specifically, I think, got him off to a great start. And Rossington could be a really dangerous batter. He was a bit expensive, but he took those wickets. Paul Walter, obviously, got Crawley, McDermott, Morgan at crucial times. Those wickets were big. Matt Parkinson, I thought, bowled really, really nicely. 17 runs off his 20 deliveries. And we talked about the London Spirit don't like 2 things, really. The ball turning away from them, specifically leg spin, and high pace. And they had Hartley, Parkinson, Gleeson, Little. So left arm spin, leg spin, high pace, and I guess vibing with Paul Walter. So they matched up really nicely, and I never really felt like 150 was enough.
No, you said it's a really bad matchup for the Spirit as a whole in that game. I agree with you. They are a bit of a strange team. I mean, they're wisp. Like a bit of a sort of like every player feels like a bit of a meme of themselves to some extent. But I think, yeah, the Originals have been very, very weird all season, but they obviously had that massive advantage of basically having a 20 balls a game fast bowler. They basically didn't really know they'd signed in Paul Walter, who has just come out of absolutely nowhere. I think, was it one over for Essex this summer in the Blast? I think he bowled. But yeah, it's again, I think this game went the way it should have gone, but like the women's game, that the better team on the day definitely won it, even if I don't really understand what the Originals actually do as a team.
I think that's a great way of summing them up. Like, I have absolutely no idea who the Originals were supposed to be. Like, the whole point of the Originals really was it was supposed to be the big hitters, the big stars, Butler, Russell, Hasaranga, and all these hitters. When Overton was supposed to be there, they brought in Stubbs. They're supposed to be these really powerful hitters, and they end up being a team that seem to be depending on Evans and Madsen with the bat and Paul Walter with the ball. I just do not understand anything about what they're trying to do. And there's a mailbag question that's come in from the Manchester Originals fan account. Does the performance of the Originals throughout this tournament demonstrate the importance of shrewd acquisitions and the team collective rather than big name signings and relying on moments of individual brilliance? I'll be honest with you, this podcast throughout this whole thing has been very harsh on the Manchester Originals. We said they'd be terrible coming into this tournament. I think we were kind of proven right those first three games. We thought they were terrible. And I really don't want to backtrack on that. I don't. And I'll tell you why. This team shouldn't work. Like, I don't think this is the Manchester Originals did some really shrewd acquisitional work. I don't think they did. Do you really think the Manchester Originals thought, you know what we need? We need a bit of bowling in this side. Let's get Paul Walter. They did not do that. They needed a left-hander because they hadn't bothered to get any left-handers who were physically capable of playing spin. So they brought Paul Walter in. He probably bowled in the nets a bit. They thought, oh, well, this is better than a bit of Fred Clarkson. Let's give it a go. And somehow he's become the best bowler in the tournament. Laurie Evans, 125K. Was he ever really going to be worth 125K when they did it? Maybe not, but he's come up to the top of the order where they didn't expect him to bat. And he's done really well in a role that seems to suit him considerably better. If he's batting down at 4 or 5 or wherever they were thinking of batting him, I mean, 6 and 7 early in the tournament, this would not be happening. It would not be happening. Obviously, losing Richard Gleeson was a big blow. But, I mean, Josh Little's come on a bit of a heater. And he's done really nicely as well. They've matched up against the opponents they needed to match up against. I don't know. Like, I think everything's gone their way. And I think they deserve credit. But I don't think it's credit on a team-building front. What I think it's credit of is the players, these bit party, out-of-nowhere players coming together. I think there's a really good article from Matt Roller which said that Paul Walter, after 3 losses, got a few beers in, got them around the table and got them talking. And that changed it. And we talk, I think people dismiss momentum a lot. And people dismiss team culture. This is an exact example of why players need to like each other, respect each other and back each other. Because this team, if they didn't play at their full potential, if everybody wasn't giving something, they weren't operating in a manner which, you know, really, really gave this team the opportunity to perform at their highest ceiling, then it wouldn't work. All of these parts had to come together. So what I really think it is, it's great captaincy from Laurie Evans, great leadership from this leadership group, and a lot of players coming together. So I don't think it's shrewd player acquisition, because if anyone takes credit for seeing Paul Walter as a fast bowler or a bowler of any kind, they have not been watching Essex cricket for any length of time. So, yes, team collective, yes. Shrewd acquisitions, no. I don't know what your thoughts are on, Jack, but that's where I stand.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I mean, I'm generally not one for captains making a massive differential, for example, but I think in this case, something, whether it probably is the captaincy or something, the culture has changed, hasn't it? I mean, they have just looked so much more confident at the start of the tournament. They just look wrecked. Like, I mean, it's obviously very hard to quantify, but the kind of feeling around seeing them on the TV was just like a dementor. Do you know what I mean? there was like a lack of kind of spark going on, but now they just seem like unbelievably confident. I mean, we sort of made a joke, didn't we, last time I was on here about Josh Little basically just like angering his way through cricket, and he has done it. Like, he's just picked up 11 wickets in 4 games out of nowhere. bowling really well. I mean, Paul Walter is like too big to fail, isn't he? Like, you're not going to hit him because he's 12 foot tall. I don't really understand it, but they have gone really well. And I think everyone's, like, on a more serious note, like, I think everyone has contributed there. I'm looking down the batting strike rates, and, you know, Salt and Butler, very good averages, but everybody else, like, even if they, no one's been clogging it up really. When like Wayne Madsen's only going at 125, which isn't great, but everybody else has been scoring quickly, even if it's not many runs.
Yeah.
Which does help. Like, and if those innings kind of fall in the right games, like they have been, that it might not really matter that, you know, Tristan Stubbs has only scored 139 runs because he's scoring them quickly and he's scoring them after guys have got in earlier.
Yeah.
So I think they have worked well in that respect. And you've got to give them credit for that. Like, their players are coming in and giving it a go with the bat and with the ball. They've been just very capable of taking wickets. I mean, they've cycled through quite a lot of bubbles, haven't they, in this tournament? I'm just looking on the list. I mean, at one point, Stanley was going to be there, the saviour of their season, playing every game. He's rotated out with Gleeson coming back in. Like you say, the discovery of Walter from kind of nowhere. I think as well, just Tom Hartley's been quite underrated. I think he's been underused at the start of the tournament. I think there's a few games where he bowled just five balls in a couple of games. And he's a very shrewd cricketer. I think probably because his bowling isn't necessarily that interesting to watch, he gets underrated. But I'm looking at his numbers this tournament. 9 wickets, average under 20, economy of 8.2. You can't really argue with that. That's really, really good.
He has been excellent. I think a couple of things have obviously changed. Sean Abbott for the first three games was awful. But a lot of respect for Sean Abbott. I think he's a very good T20 cricketer. As an overseas, maybe you're pushing it slightly. And in the first three games, he got annihilated. He improved the last couple of games. Then Josh Little's come in and, as he said, angried his way in. And I think Josh Little has improved now. He's being very angry at late 80 mile an hours rather than basically being a left-arm Ben Rain, where he screams in at 80 miles an hour and screams in your face as if he's Wakar Yunus. It's much improved. And I think the high pace of Gleeson and Little helps. Parkinson's bowled nicely. Again, they've found a role for Hartley. Hartley's a role player. Really, really nice in the power play. Good matchup against the right-handers, which he had against the Spirit. That worked. Obviously, I think the thing is that they're using the resources nicely, but what on earth would they be doing if Paul Walter was actually being Paul Walter? Like, if Paul Walter was being the Paul Walter we've watched, you've watched The Loss of Essex, we've watched The Loss of Essex, we're fully aware, and no one should be undecided on this. Paul Walter has never been a good bowler, like, in any stretch of his career. No, I'm not talking good, I'm not talking average. He went an ECB pace camp at one point because he was 6'7" and bowled relatively quickly, which was a wonderful period. But he's just not been that in T20 cricket for Essex. What if they didn't have that? There's a lot of Stubbs and Lamonby bowling more. It's that would have been an issue for them. So yeah, I agree. I think they've come together really nicely, but I think it's a collective and tactical situation rather than anything else. And I think, again, everyone's playing the role of the bat. Wayne Madsen striking at 125, there's a reason for that. There's a role he inhabits. He's played crucial innings. Other innings he's got a bit stuck, but maybe like last night didn't really matter. So I think everyone's playing their role. And I do think there is value in captaincy. And I probably believe in it slightly more than you do. And I'm not saying that you're wrong on this, but I do think you can tell when there is a competent tactical captain in place, how quickly things can change. Like, I really don't believe Birmingham Phoenix would have won as many games as they did this tournament without Moeen Ali at the helm, frankly. And I think you saw a change in how this team played with Laurie Evans in place rather than Josh Butler. And I think that's probably a slight worry for England. But I think the fact that leaders have stepped up as well in non-captaincy leadership positions has been great. So I guess the big question is, after us slagging off the Manchester Originals for the whole off-season, for the first three games, and completely rightly, let me be very clear, now we come in, they have all the momentum, 6 wins in a row, and they face the Trent Rockets. It's exactly the kind of story that you want on this finals day. I hate to ask you, but who do you think is going to win this?
I've still got the Rockets down for me, I think. I think it's really well drilled. They've got very good bowlers. The opening pair are in amazing form. And as we've seen kind of I've told them if you can get your openers in form, you can just blow teams away, because by definition they have to play a role in the game. And they're always coming in with the opportunity to shape the innings. Like, that's so I just think they will be a bit too hard to handle, I think. But I don't think it's going to be, I mean, any game in T20 can be a walkover, because that's just the nature of Pi variance format. But I don't think it's a massive mismatch at this point. I think, I just think Trent will be too professional, is the wrong word, because obviously you're professional, but you know what I mean? That, like, professional in their way they go about it. I mean, I'm just looking at their sort of top order, the batting order they're going to have. You know, Monroe's a great player, Hales and Milan are amazing form. And, you know, whilst Tom Kyler, Cadmore, Patel, Gregory doesn't set the world alight, they're all experienced, competent players, and they back down to eight properly, don't they? So I think it's going to be the Rockets. What about you?
I kind of agree. I think the Rockets have slightly stronger matchups, but they do have one big flaw that I'll come to in a moment. First of all, I think that they match up nicely as a batting side against this bowling attack. You have left-right combinations, Milan, Hales, and Munro, TKC. They have lots of those right-hand, left-hand options, which I think will be really, really helpful for them. I think it ultimately means, well, how much are you going to bowl Hartley when Milan's at the crease? I wouldn't want to. How much are you going to bowl Hartley at Munro? I would not be bowling Hartley at Munro. Like, I don't think there's a situation, if Munro's at the crease, where I could give the ball to Hartley. We saw what Munro did to Graham Van Buren in the Rockets versus Phoenix game at Trent Bridge. He pummeled him. And Hartley's a really nice bowler, but Munro's going to take that matchup down, I think, especially with those short square boundaries, because he loves to sweep. So that's a big issue there. And then also against Matt Parkinson, do you really want to be bowling too much Matt Parkinson against Colin Munro? Not a great deal. So I think there comes the issue. And then obviously, you know, Josh Little's a good bowler, but he's a streaky bowler. He's angry and fast and in your face, and that's great. But we've seen in this tournament that he streaks well, he takes wickets, he doesn't go for many runs, great. Then in one or two overs, it can all fall apart. I think in his first game, like, literally all of his runs came off one set he bowled rather than the two he bowled up front. That's kind of what he could be. And if you have Hales and Milan, who are in great form, there's no reason to say that it couldn't be that they keep the pressure on him. Gleeson as well, you know, a good bowler, but if, you know, Milan and Hales can kind of keep him out of the game, ultimately the matchups weigh in their favour. It's much easier to hit Paul Walter, you'd think, with those short square boundaries. Because you can get that elevation, you don't have to have as much pace to get it over the boundary. So overall, I think the Rockets match up really well against that Manchester Originals bowling attack. And I think they'll probably have to turn to the likes of Stubbs with the ball. I think that'll be actually really, really crucial. I think Laurie Evans needs to show that he can kind of be a flexible captain, the fact that he's got those five bowlers are going really well. But in this situation, yes, Hartley's bowled well this tournament. You need to give the ball to Tristan Stubbs, which is not a sentence I ever thought I'd say. But use the fact that you have a million part-time off-spinners in your side to get some value against those left-handers. So that'll be interesting. And then I also think with the ball, obviously we know very well that Originals have lots of right-handers. Samet Patel bowled 20 balls for 20 runs and an absolute run fest last time these teams met. So that'll be crucial. But they don't have Tabrai Shamsie. He's gone to the CPL. They haven't got a replacement leg spinner in, as far as I can tell. So what their options are Matt Carter and Marchant De Lange. So they can either go with two overseas players, or they'll have to play Marchant De Lange. Interesting conundrum for them there. And what I will say is Matt Carter is good against right-handers, which is weird as an off-spinner, which will be helpful, but no Tabrai Shamsie, and that is a monumental loss for a side that's bowling is a little bit dodgy, and we've known that all tournament.
Yeah, Shamsie's a big loss, and that decision that I've got there is quite a tough one, I think. I'm not sure I'll be picking Carter the first game. I think I'll probably go De Lange. It is a hard one, because, like I say, Carter is good against right-handers, but I just feel like more spin to the Originals, I wouldn't really want to be bowling massively. I don't want to be bowling Carter at Wayne Madsen.
No.
Yeah, and like you say, the Hartley, I think, will be a big problem for the originals because the matchups are just so poor. I mean, even Hales hits left arm spin really well.
Yeah, Hales, Hales takes down spin. I think there's a perception of him as this seam hitter, but he can take it down.
No, definitely. I mean, you don't, I mean, if I mean, Memorage been floating, hasn't he? But if Memorage comes in at three, you're looking at basically not being able to bowl Hartley while any of those top three are in.
Mm.
And the form they're all in, one of them's probably going to face at least kind of 35, 40 balls. So then you're thinking, well, you're leaving Hartley out of a large portion of the game. And a period of the game he's really effective in the power play. Mm. Personally, I think I probably would open a bowling with Tristan Stubbs, which sounds insane. But Hales actually hits off spin worse than left arm spin. And Milan has been absolutely shocking versus off spin this summer, which is amazing considering how good he's been.
Mm.
I mean, he's averaging about 10 against off spin this summer. And I just feel like, given that Milan Hales anytime, Milan at the moment can just hit your first 10 balls for 20 runs, kind of regardless of who you're bowling, you might as well throw Stubbs in to get that extreme matchup. And yeah, if it works, it's amazing. If it doesn't work, at least you've burnt through 5 balls and the outcome isn't necessarily any worse than it'd be if you'd thrown up your best seamer or whatever. So I think that is a possible way they can get out of, you know, if you can get through 10 balls from Stubbs, you may well get through 10 from Hartley, potentially. And that doesn't leave in a situation where, you know, 5 of your last 20 balls are from Hartley to Milan, who's on 80 not out or 40. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's going to just completely car park him and there's not much you can do about it. I mean, we saw this earlier in the summer, didn't we, with Matthew McKinnon and Riley Russo down at Taunton, where, like, I think for a lot of people, it probably just was the first time you'd seen, like, how a matchup can be so bad that it's not the bowler's fault. They've just been completely given a hospital pass, basically.
Yeah. And that was a rough night for McKinnon. I really felt for him. Yeah. And this is the sad thing about it. McKinnon's a nice bowler. I'm not saying he's a great bowler. He's a nice bowler on a flat track against Riley Rousseau with the ball turning in. What are you going to do? Like, you can be as good a left arm spinner in the world. If Ben Dunk is going to be charging down the track to you, you have absolutely no chance. That's where I think matchups are really big, and you can debate how important they are, but if you give your bowler a hospital pass, that's what happens. And I really felt for McKinnon that night, and I agree that's something that they'll have to be really wary of, because Hartley's a good bowler, but short square boundaries, that could be a game changer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's not something I would be. I mean, there are people out there saying, you know, if you got to back yourself versus anyone because you're a professional or whatever. But I mean, there's being confident in yourself, and there's also just being sensible.
Yes.
And
you don't have to bowl Hartley there. Like, you don't have to. No. Like, he can bowl somewhere else. You've got Richard Gleeson. Like, you've got other options. So I know, back yourself, but as a captain, you can back one of your other really good bowlers.
Yeah, exactly. It's not terminal with the original, certainly, but I just felt it's something they would really like to do. And if they don't nip a couple out early, then they're going to be in this tough situation of assessing, do we bowl our really good bowler in Hartley, or do we bowl 20 balls of Stubbs, more or less because he's an off spinner, not because he's a very good batter, but he isn't an all-rounder, he's a batter that bowls a bit of off spin. I think those decisions at the end, they can be quite sort of distracting for a side. You know, yes. You know, you've got to get 10 balls out of one of them, you don't know which, you can kind of, there's a lot going on. Sometimes those decisions go very wrong because of just how much is going on towards the back end of the innings. And it's something you probably just don't want to have in a final, sort of lingering over you. So, I mean, I do well, they nip two out, they get Hartley on for 10 early, and then, you know, they're away, Walter can bowl through the middle, go for no runs again, it'd be all great. But yeah, I think if the Trent Rockets get in, it could be very, very tough for the originals to get a hold of the game.
And I think also there'll be a really crucial period of this game where the Rockets could put up a score and then end the game with Luke Wood, basically. Luke Wood has been good this tournament. He's taken wickets up top. He's swung the ball at decent pace. He's a really good power play operator. We know that. Say the Rockets put on a competitive score. Now, we don't know what the pitch is going to be like, but let's just say they put up 170, 180. That's a big score. That's not just a competitive score. That's a big score. Luke Wood gets and nips Salton Evans out early. The game could be done because, you know, those guys really are the key of your batting lineup. If you're chasing 170, 180, you lose Evans and Salt. Madsen, Walter, Stubbs, Turner, Lallenby, good players. If Luke Wood nips two or three out early, that could be a big part. So I think that's something to really keep an eye on. But the rest of that Rockets lineup, I mean, surely you fancy it. Like I with those short square boundaries on a hopefully a decent flat pitch, I reckon Tristan Stubbs is eyeing up the likes of Sam Cook, Matt Carter, everyone basically. So I think that little 20 ball period will be really, really key. And Luke Wood steaming in, can he change the game with the new ball? I think that would be a case where Phil Salt has a kind of weird situation there where he needs to just work out how aggressive he needs to be in that lineup where actually, you know, he's the guy that should be playing the beginnings in this game. I think that's a big issue that Phil Salt kind of has to take on his career. Phil Salt's a really great dasher, really, really good player. I think the question is he anything, can he be more than that consistently? Like, if he's going to be picked up in the Big Bash League, which he has been, if he's going to play for England, if he's going to be the star of the Manchester Originals in a quality tournament like this, he has to be just more than a dasher. The dasher's really great, and I'd love Phil Salt that way on my team. But you have to, in these big games, sometimes do a bit more than that. And I think that's where an interesting part of his career comes now. I think Laurie being really aggressive last night really helped. I think Laurie being aggressive at the top will be helpful. Interesting way of seeing kind of Salt perform. I'd be interested to see how he approaches this, just not in this game, but when he plays for England and in crucial games in franchise cricket.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I think Salt for England, the way England structure up, is fine just going off as hard as you like. And to be honest, most of the time I think he is fine doing that, but I agree today. Wood really is the threat. He'll hit the stumps a lot. And like you say, short square boundaries. You fancy Carter or DeLanger because they are tall and they get bounce. And, you know, they will be on for sort of hip, and he'll be able to try and flip that away or put it away. I mean, DeLanger's going to bowl short balls because that's his thing, right? That's his USP. And Carter will get a lot of bounce that you can sort of get under, I think, potentially. So I can see a world in which Salt today, I'm not saying he'll go 15 or 15, but he maybe won't go ballistic against Wood, who is going to be targeting those stumps and has been so good. And then he might be able to, you know, cash in later on against those bowlers. Aren't bad bowlers, but they're not also not amazing. And they maybe just don't suit the dimensions of the ground they're playing on this particular game on.
Yeah, I'd agree on that point. And I think also Luke Wood's a weird one, so you don't want to pull him. I think because he's just so skiddy and comes through so quickly off the pitch. I think you saw Will Smead get out this way against him. You don't want to be bowling the length where you're tempted into pulling him, because it's just really, really not a good idea. So that's an interesting point. And I agree. I don't think they can play March and DeLanger on this ground. Those short square boundaries, this isn't like if it was the Blast, say, and you were playing lesser quality batters, maybe you could do it, tempt them into playing those shots. March and DeLanger's bowling heat. Hales is the kind of player, obviously, on the Trent Rockets side who would eat that up in a high-quality competition. And on the Manchester Originals side, you have lots of high-quality players who are going to fancy that. Tristan Stubbs, Ashton Turner, Tom Lambie loves hitting pace. Paul Walter as well, Salt Evans. These guys aren't going to step down from that matchup. They are. They're going to take it, and they could take it down. It'd be very high variance by DeLanger, so interested to see how they go on that front. We've obviously both said we fancy the Rockets. And we'll get into a couple of mailbag questions on that front in a moment. But first of all, I have one key question for you. We talked about the off-spin to David Milan. Which of the Manchester Originals' four part-time off-spinners do you think matches up best against David Milan? We've got Tristan Stubbs, who they seem to prefer, and Wayne Madsen not bowled a lot this tournament, Ashton Turner and Colin Ackerman. Who would you choose? And do you think there's a genuine conversation in the Originals camp about which of their four part-time off-spinners they give a go?
Yeah, it's a peculiar one, isn't it? I mean, I genuinely would have thought Ackerman would have been the way to go at the start of the tournament. But like you say, they seem to like Stubbs for whatever reason. I mean, I'm not really sure what they're basing it. I mean, he bowled for South Africa a bit recently, didn't he? But he actually doesn't bowl an awful lot back in South Africa, I don't think, looking at his numbers. A lot of his overs seem to have come in the last like 6 months. But yeah, I mean, I don't think it's make a huge amount of difference, to be honest. I think it's probably just whoever fancies bowling the most. You know, at that level of bowling, which is like, yeah, part-time, good part-time, but part-time, it probably just, the confidence to actually bowl probably is the deciding factor on who gets a go, I'd imagine. But yeah, I don't think it makes a huge amount of difference. And I think sometimes it's like, your bowl starts because he's pretty decent, and also he's your overseas, so it just feels like you want to get more value out of him, perhaps, which is, yeah, fine, I suppose.
We'll get on to some mailbag questions, which go slightly deeper into this final, but let's quickly touch on the women's final. Obviously, we talked about the Eliminator, Rockets go out, Brave go through. Here we are again, Brave versus Invincibles in the final after last year. This is the revenge game for the Brave. This is the prove it game for the Invincibles. The Brave won their matchup early on in the season and relatively comfortably. The Brave are a stacked roster with just a huge amount of quality. The fact that, and they have, and I don't know if this is something you've noticed yet, they've lost two games in the 100 so far. That's not this year, that's both years. And they haven't got a trophy yet, and they still had to go through the Eliminator this year. Their one loss was enough to take them through to the Eliminator because of the six-game season being shorter by the Commonwealth Games. So really weird piece of luck for them there. The Oval Invincibles versus the Brave, where I say, where does your heart go? Where does your brain go? But I guess it's very difficult to say because we have no idea if Marizanne Kapp's playing yet, and that really is a bit of a game changer if she does or doesn't.
Yeah, that's obviously massive. I mean, Kapp is one of the best women's cricketers of all time.
I'll let you get on your point. I think Marizanne Kapp is the best T20 cricketer on the women's side of it of all time. That's a debate for another time. But
yeah, very potentially, and obviously that's a huge deal. I'm going Brave. I'm probably going to do what I did last year and go with Cousin Brave and be wrong. But I just feel like they're so stacked players. And I thought they were incredible at the start of the season. Mm-hmm. And then, like, Georgia Adams has been a lot better than I thought she'd be. I mean, part of that is perhaps me just underrating Georgia Adams and just being stupid from that count. But I thought perhaps she was the one player that didn't excite me in their team, and she's been incredible this season. So they just seem, what, 1-11 so strong. And I think their opening bowling partners, but the Invincible strength is their opening batters. Like Whitford Hill and Bates have been incredible this season, and nobody else has really had to have a go. Like, nobody's scored 100 runs in their team apart from that, because they just haven't been getting in, basically. And I just feel like when you've got Bell and Shrubsole to just dry it up, Bell to come in and knock over wickets, that's such a good pair to be matching up with Whitford Hill and Bates. And I think that's going to be probably where the game's decided to some extent. And I just back those bowlers to, yeah, knock the Invincibles batters over before they can get in and get their, you know, big 70 or something.
Yeah, I think George Ryan's an interesting one. I think she didn't have a great 100 last year, which I think is kind of what you might have been basing off a little bit. And I think that's kind of fair enough. What the Brave really needed was an experienced middle-order player who could offer something as a two-dimensional cricketer. Now, Georgia Adams, not quite in the Paul Walter sphere, but didn't really expect to bowl that much this year. Her off-spin's been really, really useful and has helped them a lot, I think, with matchups and just having an extra bowler there. And we saw the last year in the final, what happened? For one time, the Brave batting order collapsed. Marizanne Kapp ran through them and they just didn't have the answers. They couldn't hack it. Georgia Adams is a really experienced player, a player who's proven it in domestic cricket for a long, long time, who has scored runs consistently, who's performed in these big moments. That experience, that quality in the middle order, just having her at 5 or 6, she won them that game against the Rockets. Like, I know Talia McGrath was match hero in the end, but that innings from Georgia Adams really changed it. I mean, well, McGrath was 31 off 29 and then took 2 wickets and got Villani and Dupree out. Played well, and obviously those 36 runs she conceded were mainly off Natsiva, absolutely going ballistic. But if you look at it, Adams 38 off 24 at the back end there was absolutely crucial. And then she also took 2 wickets, getting Bryony Smith out and getting Marie Kelly out. Marie Kelly, by the way, is the kind of player who could have added a bit of impetus alongside Siver. So, player of the game, no doubt in my mind. And the fact that you have Adams batting at 6 Kempf batting at seven is ridiculous. Maya Boucher hasn't really made many runs at all and hasn't got the chance. She scored 29 yesterday. Adams made some runs. The fact that you still have Amanda Jade Wellington, Anya Strubsole to come, and then Carla Rudd, who's not offering as much with the bat, but offers something in terms of depth, that's just kind of makes you a little bit collapse-proof. And that's kind of what happened the last couple of games. They've collapsed, basically, and they've lost early wickets. Mandana, Wyatt, Dunkley combined for 24 runs between them. It's nice that you have McGrath, Boucher, Adams, Kempf below that. And I thought that was crucial. I think if Marizan Kempf plays, and it's a really different picture. We don't know that at this stage. But it would completely change everything. And the Oval of Wisdom have actually been quite interesting, I think, as a side. We kind of expected them to depend on Danny van Niekerk, Marizan Kempf, Maddie Villiers, Alice Capsey, offering lots with the ball and then kind of packing their batting and batting deep. We thought Eilish Cranston and Emily Windsor would get significantly more game time. They're both in great form overall. I think they've only had one innings in this tournament between them, and they've gone with the bowlers. Eva Gray, 7 wickets at 12, coming at 5.8. Sophia Smell, six games she's played, she bowled and all of her overs, bowled out every single time, 7 wickets at 17, Conrad at 6.05. Alice Capsey has bowled nicely. Rhianna McDonald-Gray hasn't quite gone as well, but the fact that Eva Gray and Smile and Capsey are all kind of bowling nicely and complementing the likes of Ismail, Kempf, Capsey, Villiers, I think has just really changed this team. So that'll be crucial, though, ultimately. When you give the ball to Gray, give the ball to Smull, specifically the power play, are they going to be able to handle Danny Wyatt, great spin hitter, and Smriti Mandana? That, I think, is kind of where this matchup will ultimately come up if Kempf isn't playing. Can those domestic bowlers that kind of, I guess, come out of nowhere slightly in terms of actually playing in this tournament and performing, can they play and keep up against the most stacked roster in this tournament? That's a great advert for women's cricket, by the way, seeing Sophia Smell get the opportunity to perform against these batters. So I think that's kind of the crux of this game, ultimately, because the Brave bowling is really, really good.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see, actually. I mean, Smell have been amazing this tournament. I mean, I confess I didn't really know who she was at all before the start of it. Looks like I reckon she'll do all right in the Under-19 World Cup coming up soon. have a good comp there, I reckon. But she'll probably bowl pretty early on in the game, won't she? And it'll be interesting to see how she goes, like you said. I mean, Mandana, if she has to bowl against those openers, it will be a really tough ask. Because obviously Mandana, left-hander, will just track you and come after you. And Wyatt, it's hard because you don't want to drift onto the pads. But equally, if you just hang it outside off stump, she'll just flay you through the offside.
Yeah.
So even though she's a right-hander, she seems like the sort of right-hander who would be almost like a kind of those one of those inverted lefties, really, because that strength through the offside, your angle is just opening it up for her to a certain extent. Yeah. But I mean, it's a really great opportunity, and you know, she definitely could do it. I mean, it's not like she's expecting Smell to get absolutely, you know, hammered in this game at all. Like, she could very much come out and, you know, and she has a great game here. You know, almost like England A, aren't you? Sort of. And that sort of next level down, really, because she's been incredible this tournament.
And this is the thing. This is ultimately it. If you're wanting an opportunity to prove yourself and get into the England ranks, right, would you like to bowl at Smriti Mandana, Danny Wyatt, Sophia Dunkley, Talia McGrath, Maya Boucher? Go on, then. Let's see if you have it. That's an international batting lineup right there. All of them. And then you have George Adams and Freya Kempf, by the way, just coming in at 6 and 7, just if you were concerned. I think why it's interesting, there's just very little margin for error when you're bowling at her, because if you go down the leg side, she'll hit you hard. If you bowl too much outside off stump, it really opens it up. There's a way of bowling to her, but you have to be so accurate and so good. And so really excited to see Smell go. And by the way, she is Welsh, which is great. And that does mean that the Welsh Fire, I'm sure, will be sniffing around for next year. But she's been incredible. And again, a player who's kind of, I guess, come out of nowhere slightly. The people who watch the domestic circuit, I'm sure, will have been aware. But for those maybe who've come into this competition, for us, maybe we watch a decent amount, but not able to see every single team and every single player. she has been absolutely fantastic. So, yeah, really, really excited to see her go. I do think the Brave slightly edge this matchup, though, especially when you have a gun leg spinner in Amanda Jade Wellington as well. I just think they have the horses, and it's going to be a bit of an underdog story for the Invincibles.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we haven't spoken about Wellington, who is probably in the women's game, the second best leg spinner in the world. And has been for a long time. And it's quite a nice narrative as well, because obviously Wellington, when she was the best leg spinner in the world, probably wasn't getting picked by Australia very much. And then King's come through and obviously taking a spot on the Aussie side. I feel like, it'd be quite a nice kind of story for her to bowl really well in this final, having had a really good tournament, just be like, I am still world class, potentially world 11, but it's just that it just can't get past King, for example. I'm excited to hit, like you said, that Smale was Welsh as well, because I'm now really rooting for her to get into the England team, because I want to see at the next Commonwealth Games if she's allowed to play.
That's interesting, isn't it?
This is one of my pet things over the summer, is can Welsh players play for England in the Commonwealth Games, considering there is no Welsh team.
That's interesting. It's a weird thing on the Welsh cricketer side of thing, because Wales actually have, like in the women's game specifically, quite a few decent ones. Claire Nicholas is a really, really good role player and hasn't been used enough by the Welsh Flyer, frankly, in my opinion. Smale, again, really fun left-arm spinner. Alex Griffiths, also Welsh, I believe. And I'm trying to think who else. Let me pull up their full team, because there's actually some really, really like fun cricketers in general. But that's a nice thing, because I think there's kind of been a lamenting, really, on the men's side of things about, there's not many Welsh players playing for the Welsh Fire. Let me go you through. Here's the Welsh national team that I've got in front of me. Now, a few of them are listed as England, so that's not necessarily the most helpful. But this is more of, I guess, a Welsh domestic team, if anything. You've got in it... Oh, no, my... I'm excited to have a moment with me there. You've got within it Smale, Nicholas, Georgia Hennessy, Alex Griffiths, Danielle Gibson. Lots of good players there, who are playing on that kind of domestic level. So that would be nice to maybe get a few more of them into the Welsh fireside in general. Anyway, I think Brave for us on that front. It should be a cracking game, though. Really can't wait. And moreover, what I can't wait for is the off-season to be there, so we can find out about Marizan Cup and Daniel van Niekerk spilling all the beans about what's been going on in the Oval Invincibles, because they're not going to be back next year. So this is very much a final hurrah for this early era of the Oval Invincibles. Let's get into some mailbag questions, shall we? Two kind of related ones. First, in the YouTube comments from Tremens Delirious, who asks, does the momentum help Originals having played yesterday, or are the Rockets better prepared having had a week off? And this also links to a question from Joe. Hi, Joe. He says, I know you're not keen on the playoff format. Yep. Do you think there's an argument to say that the team that wins the eliminator could have an edge in the final, coming off a bit of form and confidence? I'm thinking particularly about the Originals men, who have now effectively played knockout cricket for 5 matches in a row after losing the first 3 matches. Make that 6 now, of course. Conversely, he spoke to Susie Bates after the match, and she was quite keen that the Invincibles women avoided a late night bus from Manchester to Southampton last night, and instead get a leisurely drive down to London earlier in the week and an extra day's rest. This is really interesting. Would you prefer to have the momentum going off last night? Or would you rather not have to take a bus from Southampton to London either late last night or early in the morning, and then go straight into the game with a bit more time to prepare? Interesting. Basically, it's a concept. Do you want to be preparing for this game for 3 or 4 days, or do you want to come off this game and just vibe it?
It's a hard one, isn't it? I think it pretty depends on the players. I mean, personally, I would want the rest, but I'm not a professional sports person, so I'd be tired.
We'd love the rest. Like, if I'm playing a cricket match, I need 2 weeks off, mate. So for us, let's give it as much time as possible.
I think it would just depend on the players. I mean, I think perhaps for maybe for younger players, it might be nice to have played the night before. You're not sitting around thinking about it, if you know what I mean. You're just getting straight into it. Perhaps for those more experienced players who like finals just aren't really a massive deal for them because they've played in loads of them, it'd be quite nice to get down, you know, be in, just be kind of resting, planning as well. I guess for the senior players in the team who will do a lot of the planning of matchup, et cetera, that'd be really nice, I think, because they'll keep themselves busy. But yeah, perhaps if you were a really young player, just having 3 days to kind of think about it, but not really do anything, might not be the ideal. I mean, ultimately, I don't think it's going to determine the result of the games massively. I think some players will like it, some players will dislike it, but at the end of the day, when they get out there, they'll just be playing hard and they're all going to be fit enough and professional enough to not be bothered by playing two games in a row, also not be bothered by having a few days off. I don't think it's going to make a huge difference personally.
I think it's a dependent factor, ultimately. The London Spirit, who started this tournament really well and could have got through straight away, I think it would have been a bit, they wouldn't have wanted it. For the Originals, are on absolute heater. Keep playing cricket games. Don't think about anything at any time. Just keep playing cricket. That's what they want. They've played 6 knockout matches now and they've won all of them. Bring on tomorrow. At this point, they're going to be travelling up. They're not going to be thinking. All they're focused on is the final. No time to move away. No time to doubt yourself. No time to really consider anything. You head into the ground, getting a decent night's sleep, hopefully. In you go. That's a benefit for the Originals, I think. So it really depends what kind of situation you're in. So, yeah, but as a professional cricket team, I don't think it should matter a great deal. Especially with the 100 format being so short, you'd hope that you could be fully rested and fine to go. So, yeah, I think in general, especially with finals though, we see them play 2 games on the same day. You know, it's, I don't think it makes a massive, massive difference. Mailbag question from Chris. Is having the semi-finals the day before the final fair for fans? If you're a Manchester Originals fan who would love to go to Lords, it's very short notice. Surely we need to be playing the semi-finals / eliminator earlier than the night before. I think this is an interesting one because I don't think the 100's really built for passionate fans of franchises, really. It's built for people to go along and have a really nice time watching the cricket and enjoy high quality cricket. That's what it's really built for. But I do kind of understand, like, if you've been watching this team, you know, for example, if you're a Manchester Originals fan, you've gone and seen all 4 home games, maybe you pop over to Headingley as well, just to see a bonus game as well. And, you know, you're going along, say you've got a couple of kids, they've gone as well, a couple of friends have gone and enjoyed it, and you follow the team and it's been great. And the kids say, oh, I want to watch the final. It would be really nice to have that notice because now what are you doing at 9:30? Booking a £3 million train ticket and kind of running down there on the last day and trying to find a ticket. It's very difficult. So I kind of agree to an extent, and I think it's slightly annoying, but I'm not really sure what else you could do because I think with the format of the 100, this really needs to be bang, 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 bang. Entertainment keeps on coming, keeps on coming, keeps on coming. We had that great night last night. All the momentum's with the tournament, keep it going. So I kind of sympathise, but I don't necessarily think it's going to change.
Yeah, excuse me. I'm kind of with you. There's kind of a few options you have, aren't there? So you need to have the final at the weekend, right? Mm. Obviously. So for this to have changed, you'd either need to have started the tournament earlier to get another weekend in to essentially let the tournament, or finish it later, or double up more games, have more 4-game days.
Yeah.
If you try to extend the tournament either way, there'd be riots at Lords and people occupying the pitch, I think.
Yes.
And having 4 games in one day, I think, is just confusing. Like, if you're a casual fan of the competition, you're not going to bother following 4 games on one day. Like, me and you probably will bother, but like people who just want to see a bit of the cricket, like, it's a lot.
Yeah.
And also, I think if you were to do this, like when I checked on, I looked at the tickets earlier this week, probably 5-6 days ago. It didn't look like they were holding back tickets to sell after the eliminator. So if you're not going to do that, it doesn't make any difference anyway, because no one's getting the opportunity to then go and buy the tickets because their team's made the final, which itself could be a mistake. But given that you're not doing that, you know, even if this had been 3 days to go, you still wouldn't be able to get a ticket, I don't think, or not very many Manchester Originals fans would be able to get a ticket for the final Lords anyway.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of another part of this as well. It's like, I don't think Lords is the right place to be holding the final, personally. One, just because the vibe isn't right for the competition. But also because, like, I think one of the things that really works with Edgbaston in the Blast is that not exactly, but Birmingham is pretty much in the middle of the country.
Yes.
So wherever you're a fan of, unless you're a fan of Durham or Somerset, you're basically got not a horrific journey to get there. Mm. It's always, yeah, it's in the Midlands. You know, it's pretty convenient for fans of basically any county. So I think they may have missed a few tricks with this, but they are kind of tied by the fact that if they were to stretch out the scheduling, it'd take more of the summer out. You know, county members would be very, you know, like justifiably annoyed and stuff, and it'd just be a mess, really, I think.
Yeah, and those are that kind of touched on themes we'll go into our next couple of questions. And it touched on a question from Basball Enthusiast on Twitter, who asks, is there a case for switching the venues for the Royal London One Day Cup and the 100 and playing the RLODC at Lords, traditional, and the 100 at Trent Bridge, lovely short boundaries, central entertainment? Nottingham is not central, right? I'm going to be very clear here. I live in Reading, which is central as all hell. You can go anywhere from Reading. It's the best part about it, the travel links. It took me forever to go watch a game at Trent Bridge. Nottingham is not central. So just to be fundamentally clear there. I don't really have a huge opinion on where the Royal London One Day Cup final is, to be honest with you. If anything, I'd quite like to maybe see it at a... and maybe one of the home venues for one of the sides, or just a nice neutral venue that kind of rotates. I really think it needs to be at Lords, though. I went to see, I think it was Durham, play Warwickshire in a fantastic One Day Cup final, 50-overfold, a few years ago, my dad, where Jeetan Patel bowled, possibly the greatest spell of all time. I watched Ben Stokes bat live for the first time, and it was fundamentally wonderful. So if it was at Lords, I'd love that. I think that'd be quite nice. And I kind of agree with you. I think actually that the 100 should probably rotate away from Lords. I get it's the home of cricket, but the vibe at Edgbaston Oval is better for the 100, to be honest with you. I think it's very weird seeing the pavilion and trying to explain to my sister what exactly that is. with all those people in weird ties and hats, while the rest of it feels like the 100. So it's a bit of a weird vibe. So I don't mind it being a Lord. I like to rotate it, go to Oval, go to Edgbaston and mix it around a bit. I don't think you can go to all the grounds. Don't think you can do it at Sphere Gardens. Don't think you can do it at Trent Bridge. I think you probably have that core three, but yeah, I'd love to see it rotate round. And, but I don't really have an opinion on where the 50 over cup is, to be honest. If it is a Lord's, great, but yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I'd like to see it at Lord's purely because I'm not particularly bothered, but you know, one day Lord's final is like a historical thing and some people like that. And if some people like that being a thing and other people don't care, I don't see why you would do the thing that some people care about and other people just don't care about. 100 final rotating would be cool. I mean, you could have it at Sophia Gardens because you're guaranteeing a neutral venue, aren't you, every year? But
you're not guaranteeing a great crowd, I guess, is the issue. I like Sophia Gardens, but with Edgbaston and Oval, it feels closer, it feels bigger, it just feels like a proper big venue. I think you'd have to have a real venue, as much as I like Sophia Gardens. You need it to be at one of the big ones.
Yeah, no, I think definitely. Yeah. I mean, somewhere like, I mean, Oval would be good. Went to a 100 match at Oval last year, which was cool. Yeah, I haven't got a huge strong opinion on it, but I think probably switching them around and having the One Day Cup at Lords, because people will like it, the members will like it, whether that matters or not is an interesting question. But yeah, and then 100 moving around. Also, if the 100 is meant to be like getting new fans involved, rotating it around the country just kind of makes more sense.
Yeah.
Because people, like you say, a lot of people there with kids and stuff, you're not likely to make your kids trek across the country to see a cricket match. Whereas if it just comes to you once every 3 years, you'd be like, yeah, why not?
I think that makes sense. If the One Day Cup finals at Lords, fine. Keep it there. Rotate the 100. I think there's lots of good places. But don't go to a venue like maybe Trent Bridge or Sphere Gardens that I don't think can quite handle the massive, massive, massive occasion. You can't pack people in, maybe. So, yeah. We'll do a very quick answer on this because we kind of answered it in our previous discussion. George asks, which players do you fancy to shine on finals day and which matchups would you use to exploit weaknesses in your opponent's side for both games? We've done weaknesses, so give me one player that you fancy to shine.
Lauren Bell, I think, is my tip to just dominate that first 20 balls of the innings and I think steer it towards the brave.
Yeah. I think Lauren Bell's fantastic. Really, really good bowler. I think she'll absolutely shine. And let's go with a seam bowling wicket taker as well then on my end with Luke Wood. Two bowlers that could really change the game early on. As you say, with the Oval Invincibles top order being so dominant, we haven't seen the middle order yet. Go on, Lauren. Take the new ball. Let's see that middle order. Same thing with Luke Wood. Luke, get into him early. I think those two are going to be really key. Final question from Xavier. How do we feel about the 8-game group format, or 6 for the women? And let's just say 8 groups for each, obviously, because the Commonwealth Games kind of interfered there. Manchester Originals men showed how you can turn things around, and London Spirit men the opposite. But would 10/14 games over a longer period, or with more 2-venue match days, be beneficial for the competition, or is short and sweet better? Now, to be clear, I don't really care about what, you know, everyone was on the kind of county schedule side of things on this question. Like, I don't really care if people get annoyed. What I care about is the fact the competition wouldn't be as good. Like, I think the 100 absolutely has a place. You still need to play county championship cricket. You still need to play the Blast. I don't think extending it to 10 or 14 games would be a good idea on that front, because you still have to play other cricket. The 100 should be a great, fun thing that happens. We all love it. I don't think you can really afford to squeeze anything out further. That's one point. I think the even worse point is you cannot be the Big Bash. The Big Bash was great. Like five, six years ago, the Big Bash was amazing. I loved watching the Big Bash. One of my favorite tournaments. Kind of, I genuinely enjoyed it just as much as the IPL. I always thought it was great quality, good fun, just generally a good laugh. They extended it to the point where now it feels like the Big Bash goes on forever. Like, it goes on for 2 months now, I think, of the Big Bash. It's ridiculous. Like, I watch about 2 weeks and it just feels like a grind. I think the quality is not as good these days either, but you really can't afford to be the Big Bash. You can't afford to get greedy. What is great about franchise cricket is that it's short, it's sweet, it's fun, you have a great competition. And as we've seen last year, you can get interesting things happen with these 8 games. The story of the Originals now going up against the Rockets, who've been the best team in this tournament overall. You get that. I think you get all the matchups you want. You get every team playing each other. I think 8 games is perfect. What you can't do is ignore everybody and squeeze the championship out. It's probably not a good idea, I think, functionally. And then also, you can't become the Big Bash, get greedy and extend it to 14 games. It's just, and there's a reason the Big Bash are trying all these gimmicks, because it's awful and it's all falling apart, and it's their own fault for extending it. So yeah, I do not extend it any more past 8 games would be my point. The only extension I'd make would be to add semi-finals, because I like semi-finals. But other than that, I really, really don't think that extending the tournament any further is a good idea.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, again, just from like a purely personal perspective, I would happily watch more games, because you get more chance for people to perform against kind of high opposition, and you learn more about players if you're interested about individual players' kind of relative ability. But I think for an actual tournament spectacle, it kind of wouldn't improve it. I mean, like you said, you're going to extend it into September and you'll squeeze the championship out a bit, which will annoy people, and it's just not worth doing at all. And so the only way you could do it would be to have more 4-game days. And like I said before, I just think it's a bit confusing. Not confusing, that's the wrong word. People can understand it. It's more that, like, it's just a lot to pay attention to. Like, for instance, me and my family went to a game this summer, and like, we watched Phoenix. And my mum was like, oh, I'll probably just like support them for the tournament. And just occasionally walk in and be like, how are they doing? Oh, they're on TV. How's this game going? Whereas if it was playing every other day, I think people would just, who are casual interest in the team, would lose that interest, because they're not looking to spend their summer looking at cricket like maybe me or you are. They're just getting on with their lives and they want a casual interest in it. Yeah. So yeah, I think it would aid the competition probably from a fairness point of view of teams that get through and from what you learn from it. But actually, as a spectacle, I think it would decrease it. And like you say, you don't want to be the Big Bash where, like, you know, your own players can't even be asked to play in it because it just takes so long. And you end up with grade cricketers just turning up because after 16 game season, like, you just get injuries.
Yeah. Fairness is overrated. I've said this for a long time. I don't care about fairness. Like, oh, well, if we'd have played in a 14 game tournament, we'd have been better. We're playing an 8 game tournament. Get your stuff together, as it were. I just think that the 8-game tournament, this month-long thing, it just feels right. It feels like it's been fun. It feels like it's good. We feel like we've got a nice spectacle, and you always want to be left wanting more. So yeah, I think it's worked. And then what's nice is you end, and hopefully, you know, you can get a little bit of interest in the final couple of County Championship games. But then hopefully people will want to come back and want to see more early season cricket next year. And I think that's what you want. I think if this thing starts taking 2 months and there's no space for the Championship, no space for the One Day Cup, it's just not, it's not going to work. So I think that would be a good, a really, really bad idea, just all around the board. I think just, yeah, on an engagement spectacle and then actual other cricket that also exists. And also, it'd be a nice, you know, you want to keep that short window so you can get some test players playing. So I think that probably makes sense. Right, that's kind of it. We've run through all the mailbag questions. Thank you so much for all of them. We always really appreciate doing this. We always really enjoy doing this. Well, we've got quite a while now until the final, kind of a 4.5 hour wait, I think, for game one. So this will be out as a podcast by hopefully 11-ish. So if you want to check out the full thing again, you can do so. Obviously, go follow Jack on Twitter. It's @cricket_pig.
Yes.
It is. There we are. Yes. Nailed that. He does a load of great stuff. If you want to be following kind of franchise cricket in general, there's loads of interesting things. And this has been a really lengthy preview. I've enjoyed it. So I'm not going to start talking to you about left arm leg spin because I think we'd go for another hour.
Oh, yeah.
But there's genuinely like, there's so much good stuff over there. And I'm sure we'll have Jack on after the tournament for a couple of fun things. So thanks for joining us, mate. And enjoy the final stuff.
Thanks for having me, you too. Speak to you later.
Speak to you later, mate. And if you want to join us at Podcast 100 on Twitter, we'll have loads of stuff through the day, and you can find more of our episodes throughout the tournament on our feed. So thank you very much for listening. Goodbye on YouTube, and goodbye on podcast as well. Two platforms, how wonderful. Speak to you soon.